there's a fee. There's a fee for the involuntary cultivation of dispassion. The media beams out messaging, and we naively think that the media is conducting itself in a responsible, neutral, democratic, educational manner by reporting on salient events or geopolitical movements so that a well-educated constituency can conduct itself in a ethical and sustainable manner as a representative democracy. But the media has been taken control of by influential forces that are not dedicated to its, you could say, original charge, and are using the power of concentrated broadcasting to pollute the atmosphere of human susceptibility, human credulity, human naivete. So it's a violence that's being perpetrated.
The fee?
Yes, the fee is everyone and everything you've once known. It's a very high price. The fee is the entirety of the illusory stage play of what you call your life. Well, yeah, it's Borg-like. It's definitely Borg-like. But you see, the Borg got tripped up. You know, they may have been one mind as they were assimilated biomechanically, but they were led by a, you know, benevolent dictator at the head of their consciousness, who was a nefarious, opportunistic woman.
Of course.
Yeah. Yeah. So at first I wanted to side.
Affectionately.
I wanted to side with the Borg, thinking that perhaps they had achieved an enviable state of consciousness, being run by a woman. But it didn't turn out that way.
I can remember what the Lord is now that you're describing it. I'm just kidding.
I did have a
fading in and out of heaven.
Yes.
An episode where it came down, but surprise, surprise, it's another villain.
Yeah, and the Borg were portrayed, you know, as a villainous, intrusive anti-consciousness that wanted to rob you of your autonomy and individuation, so that you would become biomechanically assimilated into a mind that was no longer your own.
That's kind of like what's going on.
I don't know. It's the analogy is, you know, it's in your hands.
Such politics,
the board's fun to play with. The Matrix, I think, is great fun to play with, even though it's kind of twisted and, you know, all of these analogies are fun. You know, but yeah. They, you know, I guess danger is taking them so literally or so strongly that you actually believe the story of these goofy things.
Yes.
Rather than it for what it is.
Yeah. The yogic cessation of identification with illusory impulses is not a re-identification with something else or other. Yeah. So it's not like you're under threat of an assimilation. Though I think it can be felt that way. Why not?
Well, we are continuously living in our own assimilation into this.
That's right. You're already dwelling in a rather profound, highly pixelated, dynamic portrayal of, you know, the willful self, the individual, you know, body, mind, living anecdotally and hypothetically through wave after wave of projection. That's the fucking Borg. We're trying to go Borg free. Yeah.
Well, sometimes I wonder how we. It almost sounds like that we're trying to go to death while we're still alive. And whatever that means, you know, and you can only conjure things up as far as what that means. But at least it would seem to me that any of this mental activity and physical activity, all that, boom, it's gone, you know. Supposedly, I mean, you would think. So whatever happens, happens on a different level, if anything happens, you know.
We're speaking hypothetically about death.
Yeah, we're,
yes.
Right, best we can do, best I can do.
Yeah. I'm
trying to sort it out.
Good
Yeah, exactly. Good luck with that.
Yeah.
I'm an expert on that.
Right.
I just go to sleep in a minute. That language just won't even know. Like you, Jake, like, anyway.
Well, if you're lucky, then
it's fine.
It's fun to see where your mind or interest might wander if, you know, let's say you're not consumed with doing something about your personal suffering. If you're not consumed by distraction and you're neutral, sanguine, perhaps even, you know, quietly nourished. Where do you wander?
Mm-hmm.
You know, do you wander into some kind of confusion or distraction or, you know, activity or projection? And if we were to imagine something that could or would genuinely nourish us, nourish the soul, well, what would it look like? What would it feel like? What would it have us do? So even that which we might hunger for or pursue, secularly, spiritually, or in any other manner? What is it that we think we're after? How will we know when it has arrived and arrived to stay? And would it feel like what this feels like? Or would it feel like something other than what this feels like? Would you, you know, after reading 100 books and watching 100 interviews and sitting, you know, in front of 100 so-called teachers or purveyors of non-dual or dualistic spiritual wisdom, who or what would you align with? What
choices, man?
You think? Right?
When you got all of my choices, yep. you can't move.
Pretty frozen.
Yeah,
you can be. You can end up pretty frozen, or you roll the dice and feel somehow karmically drawn to a person, a place, or a teaching of some kind, and hope that by engaging with it, you made the right choice. You made the optimal selection.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it will turn out to be another waste of your time and money and devotion, and you'll begrudgingly or happily move on to the next stimulation.
Well, if you try to chart it, it seems like it's just fraught with peril. You're just constantly on a trip with trying to chart it.
Trying to chart what?
Well, your good fortune, your peace and harmony, basically. If you try to engineer it, you know, in a world of choice, you won't decide. Like, you know.
Or you may decide and you may turn out to be satisfied for a while, or you may decide and turn out to be dissatisfied, either shortly or a little bit down the road, in which case you'll be invited to have another choice. Right? About what you might align yourself with to optimize what it is you think you're after.
Yeah. Can't you just sort of align yourself with something? Or I'll say that I've observed that, you know, let's say, you know, I'm having a menopausally hormonal emotional day, and maybe there'll be a little bit of binging, you know, because YouTube comes through the TV. So maybe it'll be Marianne or Alan and things, and it's all over the place.
No.
And by the end of like a day or two or something with that in the background or giving it attention, you know, maybe, ooh, I'm aligned with this for like 10 minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
And I start doing something, then something else comes on, and it's like, oh, that's really great for like 10 minutes.
Yeah, that's right.
But then when it's all kind of said and done, it's kind of like,
yeah.
Yeah, like, well, so what was all that?
Yeah,
you know.
Short-term art therapy.
I mean,
you know, but for like 10 minutes, it was good.
It's kind of hypnotizing, right? I mean, isn't it kind of hypnotizing? I mean, are you really there when you're, or is it just, I don't know, I find I can go on automatic. And I'm not happy when I do that. I'm not happy. I'm just saying the things, you know, like these things that come up watching the TV show, going on Facebook, you know. I mean, I have to say, I feel good when I actually get down to doing my work. That makes me happy. But I fight myself tooth and nail against doing that. It makes me feel best, like at the end of the day, when I face the daily challenges that I have to do. But I'm so lousy at it. I'm a lazy bum. I just give in totally easily.
But see, I don't get that, I guess, drawn into it for anyone.
Well, yeah, you know,
You mean drawn into pleasant distractions?
Or no, like the path and the way. And the
I see.
Well, there's some energy to it in my case, because I'm actively avoiding things that I have to do.
Yeah.
Oh, well, yeah, sometimes it's a distraction.
Absolutely. Yeah, you're just the everyman tortured soul of every employee the world over.
Yeah, I know. I tend to harp on that.
It's a curious feeling tone.
Or do that and then read something on Night Sky and it's like, okay. Couldn't get you out of it. Anyway, whatever.
This is, you know, an interesting, call it, quicksand of consciousness. If you, let's say, soften, not through, you know, vow or choice or deliberateness, if you soften with respect to motive, interest, context, content, getting things accomplished, practical or exotic. If you run out of the familiar inertial force of yourself, what do you discover? And as you discover it, what voices might or may arise to encourage you to discover further or to set up some kind of roadblock, some kind of distraction that keeps you in the game as the durable center of your own consciousness. I mean, we are operating ephemerally and etherically. We don't nearly have as much, call it, you know, willpower or insistence as we'd like to believe. It's like early on, you know what suffering feels like, and it really sucks, and so you can articulate what it is that's bothering you, and what it is you'd like to happen or not happen, to ameliorate, you know, your existential or experiential discomforts. But as you travel down a road that has a soft shoulder, you start to lose the urgency of who it is that you are and what it is that you do and why and what you expect to get from it.
So the will just goes south anyway. Because that's sort of who you are, in a sense, is how you take yourself.
Yeah. I think that you could make a discovery. It's not meant to be a universal generalization. Right? It's just something that shows up on your way to wherever, from wherever, to wherever, nobody knows. You might discover a certain softening of what we might call the urgency of will, self-will. Less of a demand is placed on yourself by yourself. Less of a demand is placed on circumstances, events, manipulative behaviors that steer the outcomes in your so-called favor. And you're going to be invited, if not confronted, with not one but many, many opportunities to get used to that. This drags itself along for the ride. You could say till the very last moment of disengagement from, right, fantasy. Subtly, more subtly and more subtly, it drags itself along for the ride. On the adventure of, you know, some kind of, call it spiritual dissolution. Which is a different way of feeling it than spiritual fulfillment. Because nobody knows what spiritual fulfillment is.
Yeah, I know. Spiritual dissolution. That's going to throw a great majority of people into a...
Well, that's why it's refused.
Space. Yeah.
That's why it's refused.
Sure it is. It's funny. I mean
you don't keep going back to landmark course after landmark course after landmark course because you've committed yourself to a path of spiritual dissolution. You keep going back to course after course after course because somehow you've misunderstood the words of the founder, or so did he, in the conduct of his, you know, institution. And now you think that it's some kind of spiritual acquisition that you may be interested in or after. Or some kind of cleverness. Behavioral cleverness, financial cleverness, libidinal cleverness, investing cleverness, right? Domestic gross product, environmental cleverness. Yeah. You know, you listen to one might listen to interviews from time to time, and the accomplished realizer, whether feigning it or taking it seriously, makes it appear as if they stumbled into an event or a finality of some kind which released them from something else, and so there's no destination, and that's the destination, but there's no destination, and stop. I mean, right, the vocabulary that's used by so many different teachers and personas gets a little gnarly. It becomes a little strange. It's either fetishized because you've heard it too many times, or it sounds like it should be the right thing to say under the circumstances of, you know, Advaita.
And it's entertainment value, that's for damn sure.
It does. I mean, how many so-called enlightened celebrities must one listen to? And, you know, what does it do for you? Besides being a kind of, you know, spiritual voyeurism.
It gets very frustrating. I know that a few weeks ago, I'm like, okay, you know what? I just want to get a good book, you know. As I reread The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
Hmm.
I watched Luther, which is a pretty dark series. You know how Dexter was.
I've seen it.
Oh, you've seen it. Isn't that a good show?
You've seen Luther?
He's the cop, the big, like, really big black cop.
The British actor guy.
British actor, yeah. Yeah. He's so strong as an actor. I mean, he's just so strong. That's such a presence. So that's great fun. But, you know, of course, then last night I'm laying in bed, woke up at 4 o'clock. And
good sleep. Time to meditate.
Thinking of all these gruesome scenes of things that I was either reading or...
Uh-huh.
What?
Why are you torturing
yourself? It's one extreme to the other. You know, that's just what I do. That's who I am.
That's how I roll.
That's how I roll.
4 a.m. Gruesome images. Yeah. Get used to it.
I'm sick and tired of all this stuff. I even went back to Rick Archer just to see what new things are going on.
Just because you like poking pencils in your eyes.
Watch The Walking Dead. You'll have such a good time.
I hate that stuff. I really hate that stuff.
I do too, but you'll really have such a good time.
Maybe if I'd latch onto it, but I've always avoided that stuff.
Well, take heroin and then watch it.
Yeah, so
did you find anything to tickle your fancy on Rick Archer's site?
I'm trying to remember who... Well, I guess actually the last one I listened to was Tony Parsons. There might have been smatterings of some others.
Yeah.
But I didn't stick with it.
Right.
So Tony Parsons was... I mean, Rick Archer was on his best behavior, and, you know, I'm trying to...
Well, that's nice.
But he...
Sign of maturity on his part?
Yeah. He was... Well, you know, it's that British accent that brings the best out.
I see.
Is this an interview?
Yeah.
It's, the interviews are hard to watch because there's interviewers, good interviewers, are so far and few between.
Well, Rick Archer, this is Buddha the Gascon.
Okay.
And so Rick Archer is basically, he's just going to go through the same list of questions every time.
Okay.
That's what it seems to me. There seems to be a difference between the tickle that you originally get on some of these things, which I would get all the time with Eckhart Tolle, you know,
yes,
for example.
Mm-hmm.
And listening to it, we're about the 30th or 35th time.
Uh-huh.
It starts to, that tickle starts to diminish.
That's right.
It's like, yeah, okay, all right.
Yes.
Yeah, you know.
Right.
So... You know, as far as what to do when you're driving, you know, it's either silence.
Mm-hmm.
I used to always listen to podcasts. It's silence, music, radio, sometimes a podcast. I still do real-time with Bill Maher.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't even open IM that very much. It still sits on my bedside stand.
Wow. Uh-oh.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Poor Nir Sagadatta shouting from between the pages of your closed book, open me, open me, let me into your life. It's a slippery slope. We rely on the interviewees and the interviewers, though most of them leave a lot to be, whatever that word is, desired. We rely on these teachings as a context for putting ourselves in a position, in a condition, as a consequence of things, voluntary or involuntary. You know, the Buddhists and the Christians and the Hindus and the Muslims, everyone uses shame in one form or another to beguile you with the mirage of choice, if not poor choice. As if by virtue of what you do, don't do, believe in or don't believe in, you are the captain of your own suffering. which is not true. Depending on how deep you want to go into looking at, right, the consummation and gestation and birth of self.
So why would the Buddha give us a prescription? The prescription is not more cowbell.
Yeah.
The prescription.
If he had said more cowbell, wouldn't the world be a happy place? If only the Buddha had simply said more cowbell, like Christopher Walken, the entire world would just be rocking.
But, I mean, he's talking about amelioration, you know. I mean, nothing wrong with it. But
yeah,
this is the deep spiritual truth. You're suffering, you know. There's a way out. Do this and that and that and that and that and do it the right way and good luck, man.
Yeah. Well, I would imagine that Buddha was multi-dimensional, multivalent in his capacity to render teaching, amelioration, empathy, compassion, entrainment into different ways of feeling the nature of being and its constituent disappointments.
Yeah. Well, of course, I'm polarizing my expression there. Yeah.
For good reason. Most of what's been adopted as Asian, Indian,
right,
Buddhism, and Western Buddhism falls under the influence of the more materialistic or dualistic aspects of the canon, of the Pali canon, and, you know, everything that has ensued. You don't think that consciousness is going to let you off the hook so easily, right? If only by virtue of the birth of the Buddha, everyone that would take refuge in the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha would be good to go. But you don't find that. You find crazy people like ourselves running toxic and dysfunctional tapes of attention-seeking and control dramas under the guise of something called compassion. Yeah, so we are, you know, we're bananas. And you see that same politics occur in Indian holy places like Belur Math, the, you know, surviving institution inspired by the life and teachings of Ramakrishna, Sharada Devi, and Swami Vivekananda. You just see another pile of, you know, indulgence and control and authority and conformityism. And then you have thousands of exotic, you know, diversions that take you into the realm of influential toxic narcissists that run various institutions and or retreats or belief systems that enroll you in the ancient wisdom of the masters so that you can become another card-carrying zombie.
Yeah, keeps on, that's what keeps a mega in business, right?
Absolutely. Sure it does. Why shouldn't it, right? I mean, we're looking at the you could say natural, as if there were such a thing, organic byproduct of the movement and functioning and representational accusation of mind, restless mind, suggesting a reality, a context and a content, a password, and all the hazing that you have to go through to become a member of the fucking club. Yeah. And what's our measure of success? Typically, the measure of success that we bring to it is looking enviably, longingly, and jealously at, let's say, the life of someone that claims to be, or might actually be, self-realized, whatever that means. I mean, was Nirsagadatta really a big win? You know, twirling around in circles a couple times a day, doing devotional chants, you know, out of, you could say, respect and affection for his own lineage and ancestry. And then catharting and cavorting and gesticulating wildly at people, talking about the nature of the absolute, which had to have been completely enthralling, if not terrorizing. You know, and we're like, you want to be like him? I want what she's having. Right, the famous line in Harry and Sally.
Right. I can just imagine being on that second floor where he had his songs or whatever, and asking a question and having him come down. Yeah, I'm like, I'm sorry.
I know. Who could even take it?
Yeah. The din of the taxi cabs and the rustle of the people.
Talk about a bardo.
Jeez.
Yeah. Well, this is what's so, I mean, I think it's great, you know, to look into the rhythm of his, you know, so-called spiritual and secular life, either when he was on camera or, you know, lying around being himself. And he's a great example of what we were talking about earlier, suggesting that there's a fee. Right? If you're going to go anywhere near that fire, that quality or depth of transmutation in your own consciousness, then what's the fee? Everyone and everything that you believed in. But in his case, his marriage didn't fall apart. You know, he got rid of his businesses because he was disinterested in running, you know, beady shops. And at the end of his life, I guess he had enough money with the support of some, you know, generous persons to keep things modestly afloat. But inwardly, whatever that suggests, I mean, his world was obliterated. Right?
So it would seem.
So it would seem. Yeah.
You're looking at, by all expression it was.
Yeah.
Even though, like you say, he would continue on with certain routines.
That's right.
Almost out of just like this is the habit this body seems to have.
This, you know, is what we do.
Let it roll, you know. It's like when another thing when faced with infinite choice, just go with what you know.
You grab a symbol. You grab a symbol. You grab a drum, and let's do these bhajans.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, master. Great idea. Yeah. Fire it up.
It seems to work for this mind body. You know,
so. Mm-hmm. I think that speaks to the, you know, the Borg metaphor, that what you thought belonged to you, no matter how distasteful it or you may have become, you are not necessarily standing in line for the obliteration of self. You're not lined up. You're not gung ho. You're not all in.
Oh. Well, there's a few takers.
You'd be all in if you were all in.
Mm. Kinda, yeah. I mean, it's only metaphorically worthwhile speaking about because it can easily be misunderstood as if you are operating through agency, self will, preference, presumption, and, you know, what you're ready to do or not do with your, you know, unfolding spiritual curiosities.
Well, certainly the look in his eye would be enough to put many, many seekers off. Because the look in his eye...
Shortcut. Remember in the video, he almost
has
a diaper on or something.
Okay. Yeah, there's the diaper guys, too.
His name came up, and so far.
Yeah. But, you know, he...
He's a little short
guy. Yeah.
He's dead.
For all of those years of, you know,
you gotta believe.
That's right. His magnificent, you know, yogic expression ended up like they all end up.
Well, what's interesting though is here we have an example of somebody that followed the advice of his guru. Now, isn't that interesting? Because, you know, it sounds like the guru maybe followed a similar path from his guru. And I don't, you know that stuff better than I do.
Yeah.
But as opposed to people that somehow wake up, boom, what's going on? You know, they research, of course, Eckhart Tolle is the best example. They research like crazy, and they say, okay, here's what I think. I think what I figured out.
Yeah.
Do this, that. I mean, I don't mean to be as condemning as it sounds, but basically, that seems to be the approach.
Mm.
But, so I'm just comparing that with somebody like Nisargadatta, who just sort of is like, boom, boom, it's just punching you, you know?
Yes.
You know,
with, you know, loving gloves.
Yeah. Whatever, however you want to, you know.
But, yeah, but not apologetic gloves.
No.
Yeah.
He's just letting you have it. He's not holding anything back, you know.
No.
And he's not saying, well, you know, here, I understand that, but there's this, you know. I mean, he's just telling him straight, I think. Although, I'm sure he talked to different people in different ways, too. Just like people.
Oh, sure.
But, you know, of course, my mind went to Borg and Star Trek and stuff like that. And I remember the one Star Trek where they went on the planet. And they're all just sweeties. Everybody was a sweetie. I mean, just the loving, you know. And I think, is that the one? I may be mixing up two episodes.
Makes sense.
There was one.
Mix up three.
Where
there's a woman that turned into a beast and took all the salt out of your body, of marks on your face.
But there's one where there was a parasite that thrived on you somehow, and in return it gave you a really good vibe. You know, and everybody was so sweet to each other. And
sounds like republicanism.
Yeah.
Gives you a good feeling.
Kirk was like, wait a minute.
Yeah, yeah.
And then that's where he freaked out on Spock, and Spock jolted out of it. But the idea of living in a state of peaceful harmony.
Yes.
Maybe that's not the total answer. Maybe it's not just peaceful harmony, because that's what it seemed to be.
Yeah.
Not that storyline should hold any credibility for anything.
Well, they did the best they could to portray what might look like a euphoric way of living.
Right.
And then pull the rug out from under you, because it turned out to be, right, parasitic. But then you're left with, you know, another curious conundrum. It's like, I'm not sure I care that it's exactly. parasitic.
And I think that's what I'm was saying.
Living euphorically, joyfully, sustainably. Yeah. This will tease you all the way. It will tease you all the way at every turn, at every gate, every insight, every moment of sanguine, right, reflection, emptiness, one with the world, one with the universe. It's there, it's there, it's there. It will tease you. It will trip you up. Right? Last Temptation of Christ was another well-performed metaphor of that which will trip you up. You see, we tend to look at these things, right, through the lens of one's persona, one's body, one's life experience, and examining the contrasts of all the shit that, you know, we've had to endure and are likely to continue to have to endure, that creates tension and bracing and uncertainty and all manner of angst and disappointment. So we're looking at this hoping for some kind of amelioration of the vicissitudes of living. So many people bring that hopefulness to the so-called spiritual search, right? Some kind of medication, cosmic medication. But what if it's not that? Oh, what if the unfolding of one's adventure can no longer be defined or punctuated by the two things that the Buddha committed to speaking about, which was suffering and the end of suffering? What if it goes off topic, right? What if your liberation, your interest in what reality might or might not be, what if it goes off topic? And now you no longer have somebody's Bible to refer to figure out where the fuck you are in the continuum of present dissolution, present wonderment.
You just go outside.
Say again?
You just go outside and start walking.
Yeah. Take a stroll and a bit of pizza shop if you're lucky. I'll have a pepperoni slice with a lot of hot pepper flakes. But this, you know, tends to infuriate or annoy persons that haven't begun to make a more, let's call it, adult peace with their own inconsequentiality. You want to remain in the game, consequential, known, found, listened to, realizable, vetted, validated. And so you start stumbling into something that is present in your experience but goes off topic, and you can get, you know, annoyed at a minimum. Because now your capacity for feeling being, we'll call it that, has matured to the point where you can actually feel being. You can get a few moments of rest, actually, in being, and you become annoyed now with the imposition of context and content. You're still miserable, but now with something else. Oh, shit. I thought that this path would relieve me of, you know, the annoyance of myself. It hangs with you to the, you know, till the pear falls from the tree. And what do we mean by, you know, the clever suggestion of a pear falling from a tree, you know, from ripe to available for, you know, varmints and insects and humans to partake of your sweetness. Right? We still might insist on caveats. We might still be bargaining, have some bargaining chips left for what God, what she'll do to us as we slip, slide away. We will insist on and cling to anything at all, then become inconsequential beyond recognition. That's the fee.
Yeah.
That's the fee. You become inconsequential beyond recognition, beyond return. That might have a different implication than the end of suffering.
Suffering doesn't seem to count so much in that scenario.
Suffering can just fuck off.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. You know, if you come to some conclusion, we were listening to some Bat Gap stuff. It wasn't quite 4 a.m. It was still a reasonable hour, but you win. You hear certain refrains coming out of the mouths of certain interviewees about what they found or didn't find, or how they would articulate some kind of finality or great relief, right, for their realization. And so their message becomes kind of repetitive, if not frustratingly, boringly repetitive. Doesn't say anything refreshing, stimulating, or adventurous. It's just another refrain. And the refrain might have be friendly to, you know, Neo-Advaitism. The refrains might be friendly to Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. The refrain might be friendly to Tony Parsons, because someone is now, you know, repeating and mirroring the chosen means and vocabulary that he uses to talk about not self. And you're like, fuck, I've heard this before. And like you said, it was a good tickle when it first came across my airwaves, but I have somehow habituated to it. It doesn't stimulate me the way it once did. And your natural curiosity then, your natural inclination would be, what next?
And after further investigation, come to the conclusion, there's really not a what next, you know?
It's pretty strange.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. And I don't think you need to establish a baseline about your so-called condition or non-condition when there's no next. There's no what's next. Yeah. You don't need to say anything about yourself as if you're in possession of some kind of understanding. It's so much less than that. Nobody really wants to talk with you if you are non-demonstrably evaporating. They would rather be yelled at by Nirsagadatta than have to cope with their own evaporation. That's the fee. If you have nothing to add to the human conversation, right? You've lost something. Something's been taken from you. And that doesn't mean someone is going to walk up to you at Redner's and say, wow, what the fuck are you on? You know? You're not necessarily going to become a noticed, sought after, elucidating person or celebrity. You're not about to, let's say, go into hiding in a cave for long enough for people to discover you. Because when you need to go to Wawa, you go to Wawa. You know? Right? Yeah, right. Just go someplace and wait for us to discover you because you're riddled with insects and you haven't eaten or, you know, showered in weeks and you're in a...
You must be the real thing.
You must be the real thing because you're in absolute samadhi and the cats have taken over. But you see, these are the comic books, right, that are handed down from generation to generation, and everyone wants to be on the Sri Ramana Maharshi train, whether it's the Punja train or the Andrew Cohen train or the Gangaji train or the Muji train, you know, or all of the other weird Om Tat Sat motherfuckers out there that claim to have been enlightened through their association with Ramana Maharshi, peacock sodomist. Get a lot of feedback for that comment.
Yeah.
But you see,
I know how to push those buttons.
Oh yeah. Well, you know, I'm a devotional creature by nature, so I know all the ways that I'm capable of infuriating my own sensibilities. I mean, we have the benefit, you know, the thrill of a marvelous, marvelous entertaining culture of guruism. Remarkable persons transcendent of the shackles of the world, nonplussed by the curious orange hue of Donald Trump's skin. Right? Nonplussed. And, you know, we gravitate toward these persons. I mean, the church is, right, is a cult of the celebration of the life of Jesus, who was a transcendent figure. Fearless and kind, died for our sins, so he has a powerful harmonic of compassion and sacrifice. He was a miracle worker. He walked on water. He healed the sick. You know, people threw their canes out from behind the curtain and walked again. And then we commit ourselves to canonizing other persons of spiritual accomplishment who had to have demonstrated not one, but at least two third-party verifiable miracles, so that they're worthy of our stamp of worship. So this silliness persists, this false sense of hallowed holiness persists, because we are naive, we are gullible, we are doomed by the way that we conduct ourselves spiritually and secularly and in every other fashion. And this cult of, right, the miraculous permeates the Buddhist consciousness, it permeates the Hindu consciousness, it permeates Eckhart Tolle, it permeates Bat Gap, right? It permeates Berkeley and Marin, San Rafael.
You're talking about Stay away from San Rafael. What's San Rafael?
That's a lovely boutique city in Marin County.
Where Peter Lulie
lives. San Rafael, California. I wasn't picking on Peter and Lulie, though I enjoy picking on Peter and Lulie, of course. They would do the same with me, I hope. Nah, probably not. I'm too inconsequential for anyone to get any mileage picking on me.
Not true of Pebble, though, that's for sure.
Well, I handed that to them on a silver plate. Here, please denigrate me. I'll give you as much ammunition as you need. An orgy of ammunition. I'll give you an orgy of ammunition so that you can denigrate me in the way that you just love to.
That's done.
That's done. Stop it. 86. What is it that we crave? What is it that we hope, you know, to get from the master, whomever the master may be, man, woman, inanimate object, teddy bear, polar bear, teaching of some kind, right? Life extension promises, immortality, right? What are we really, really looking for? And I'm not sure if we know. Not a fucking clue. Which is kind of neat. Really, I mean, it's a little off-putting, but, you know, I mean, in this room, several times a year, a shamanic group comes together, and the School of Sacred Ministries comes together, and the Ninth Sky Sangha shows up occasionally, and there's even a Waldorf school in this very room that teaches children how to live in a pastel naked way. You know, and you can read conspiratorial stuff on the web that holds who's the founder of Waldorf?
Steiner.
Rudolf Steiner, yeah. As, you know, some kind of weird oligarchical fascist engineer of mind control.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so many people celebrate the life and teachings of Rudolf Steiner as being a Renaissance thinker in terms of, you know, cultural wisdom, cultural dignity, and education models. But of course, you know, you'll find stuff that places Steiner more or less right next to Satan.
That's just one facet of him, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, everything that, you know, we hold, you know, near and dear is fraught with something that goes south. How about the Crusades? How about the marvelous treatment of women and children under the influence and roof of the Quran? I mean, when the fabric of the hysteria of your belief system starts wearing thin and unraveling, we will, in a total panic, scamper for the next fulfillment that gives us a context, that fulfills our need for a context, because the one that we had a minute ago has clearly gone south, is failing. Right? This is what we do. And everyone shows up with, this happened to me, and now I feel this way. I don't suffer anymore, or I have vitality, I have high self-esteem, I have compassion, I have flexibility, I have, you know, the capacity to attract wealth, a good parking spot, a fantastic haircut. I can get through a JYN worksheet with the best of them. I can counsel people, I can heal people. Stare at me, I'm Brazzo. And your spinal bifida will resolve. I mean, you know, this is a fucking carny. And we are carny folk. This is a fucking carny, and we are carny folk. Yeah. And even in the midst of what an absolute hallucination it all is, I can enroll in, you know, self-criticism, self-doubt, sabotage, frustration, distraction, right? All kinds of behaviors. It looks like I'm interfering with the optimization of my own mind, my own resonance. Why do I do this? Why am I I? Why am I I? Why the way that I am I?
Why do I proceed in this fashion?
Why do I proceed and persist in the fashion that I do? Mm-hmm. Because someone gave you a ticket to the carny and you came through the gate. Yay! Funnel cake!
Smell the carnage.
Blue ribbon pigs! Yay! You know, most of the consternation that we dream is we're just having a quarrel with ourselves in a ghostly realm.
So, yeah.
Right?
I guess.
I mean, feel it.
Sometimes it seems to like break through the surface, and it's almost like, it's like, wait a minute here.
Yeah.
What's going on? You know?
Yeah, that's right.
What's happened? You know, where I'm like, wait, is this really somebody else, or is this just me expressing back?
Uh-huh.
You know?
Yes, right.
Because it's too perfect.
Yeah, that's too convincing.
It's like somebody slipped up because I'm seeing it, you know.
Yeah. Yes.
But it's just interesting that it is, it seems to be totally externalized, Yet, something fishy about it.
Yeah. You know, driving in traffic or watching TV or being in that, you know, going into or moving out of sleep stage or being at the office, right? We are living in a highly pixelated, three-dimensional, right, a delusion of oncoming traffic, oncoming psychotraffic stimulation. And our, you could say, the quality of attention is, as we all know, remarkably easily distractible. And so we veer off into one fantasy after another, one illusory context and content after another, as we just kind of get through the day, get through the life, take a nibble out of the to-do list when we can, which only seems to get filled up with five errands for the three that I just completed. The fucking to-do list never goes down, you know? And we're like, oh, I wonder if there's a pattern here. The to-do list never goes down. It only goes up. Even if you have a whole truckload of one-liners from the Big Book, from Course in Miracles, from Course in Love, from the Upanishads, right, from the Pali Canon, from the Vishnushta, Vishtishta, Vashtarshta, you know, Karsha Varnashkas.
Run into that one myself.
Yeah, those are good ones. So you have at your disposal an encyclopedia of one-liners when it comes to, you know, spiritual or secular truisms or implications. As if these one-liners actually make a difference in your experience. You are what you're looking for. That which is looking up. It goes on and on, right? It just goes on and on. There are people that know how to quote the Bible, right, to the point of giving you, you know, diarrhea. People that know how to quote Course in Miracles or Course in Love or even these Vedas and Upanishads and Buddhist literature from 12 different Asian and, you know, Eurasian cultures. The Sufis will chant and sing and twirl and practice a peaceful form of Muhammadism, of Islam, and they will give you, you know, like Baha'i. So you can sing Hummingbird and Summer Breeze. Whatever happened to Seals and Cross? Shouldn't they be like touring with the Monkees or something? You know, I mean, I'll go see Mickey Dolenz and Peter Tork, but what about Seals and Cross? Where are they?
David Cassidy would tour with the monkeys.
David Cassidy should tour with the monkeys.
Well, somebody else is a little more.
Who's what?
Davy Jones is dead, and Mike Nesmith is just off the radar when it comes to, you know, being a musical celebrity. So you're left with Mickey and Pete and backup players. I'll take it. If I can hear The Last Train to Clarksville live, count me in. I had the privilege of meeting Mickey Dolenz in L.A. He was pitching a possible TV show really? To my employers at the time.
Really?
Mickey, it's me, Jeff. He didn't take any notice. But you're a monkey. And I'm a monkey lover.
Yeah, there's a monkey. Do you remember
it? Just watch it when I was little.
Really?
We're too busy singing.
To put anybody down.
See? We know it all. We're just trying to be friendly.
I never liked it.
I don't remember any part of it other than that song. I didn't watch it, actually. I was too busy with the Brady Bunch. I haven't mentioned that before.
The Partridge.
You're too busy singing to put anybody down.
Yeah. Wish I could say the same about myself.
Just having images roll by of like Shirley Jones and Brady Bunch.
Michael Landon and Haas. Is there another planet? There's got to be better TV. Another planet.
They're on like multiple times a day.
You know, we talk about these extraterrestrials from time to time, and there's UFO conferences all over the place, but nobody's ever like shared some of their entertainment. You know? I mean, what do they do? Chip cattle and probe humans? I mean, they don't watch UFO TV. They don't have like, what about their musical instruments? You know, what do they do to keep busy? Wander around Earth, you know, evading detection because of anti-gravity machines. They've got to have something better to do with their time than visiting this loathsome place just to tip a cow. Yeah, they can run around the cornfields and play hide and seek.
And make little pretty designs.
That's right. Yeah, really. Oh, good. The sorghum crop is finally mature. Let's get out the cosmic etch-a-sketch and throw some cool geometric patterns down in the fields. Is that what you guys do for kicks? Cosmic geometric etch-a-sketch. Well, we sure got some answers tonight. We sure nailed this down.
So what did you talk about tonight? Same thing you talk about every time. How to take over the world.
How to take over the world.
I had one last night for a couple of people. We watched it.
You know, I've never watched it. I've only ever listened to it. Must be even worse when you're watching it.
Well, Suzanne sent out a little link. She watched Michio Kushi's son, Norio. Norio Kushi. A man who loves... What did he say? He said he loves wheels. The principal founder of the macrobiotic movement.
Actually George Osalos.
Oh, Osawa, that, yeah, that I escaped, yeah.
Joe was the one who
popularized it.
Huh. Anyway, this is one of his sons who had an experience.
Woke up driving a truck.
Ended up driving.
The interview was two-dimensional. But that's where they go.
He's very Japanese, actually.
Yeah.
Their family is very.
So there was nothing new.
I didn't watch the whole thing. But I was trying to remember who else I watched to see who had seen this guy.
I
remember about this other guy was that he spent some time doing heavy drugs like heroin. And then he got the whatever, and then he had some call to stop the drugs and move on into the seeker life, I should say. I don't know. But then he ended up finally with somebody named Delano, who did some sort of silent thing with him. So we watched her. She's a German girl right here.
She looks a lot like the girl in the dragon tattoo.
Everybody
movies.
Looked so solemn last night. I was watching them. You guys are terrible salespeople.
You know, you like if what's being presented is the example or culmination of realized understanding, it's like I'll pass.
Yeah.
There's like no playfulness. There's no sense of humor. There's no tickle. There's no tongue in cheek. Well, he was absolutely. He was pleasant and, you know, milk toast like.
Milk toast like, yeah.
But that's just me. Being too busy singing to put anybody down.
Right.
Song's gonna be stuck.
Uh-oh, we're fucked. Let me take some heavy drugs before I go to bed.
Lady Gaga singing whatever she's saying to people.
Uh-huh. I mean the Star Spangled Banner before the NFL Super Bowl?
Didn't she do God Bless America? Or
can you see?
Banner.
The worst of
her. That's the Star Spangled Banner.
I think it is, yeah. Any questions before we close up a scintillating conversation about spiritual accomplishment?
I think you've answered all my questions.
We're good tonight?
Go in peace.
Go in peace.
What is spiritual accomplishment?
Yeah, right.
Crazy. You want to fire that up, do you?
Just kidding.
Oh, I'm sorry. Beth always says, where are the envelopes? And I say, oh, I've got them, and then I don't put them out. Thanks. Pebble Hill thanks you for your generous contribution.
London, it's time to get up.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Hope you enjoyed this evening's program.
Look.